The third message in our series on community is entitled The Stumbling Dance of the Lost. Do you enjoy and share the love and message of God with everyone? Do you relate to the lost through humility? After all, we were all lost at one time. What is Jesus' attitude towards lost people? And how do we relate to lost people with gentleness and respect? Here's Pastor Seth.
We are doing a little three-part series called Community. Let me do a quick review. Community number one, we call the Dance of the Trinity. I think of it as the delightful dance of the Trinity, where Father, Son, and Spirit, three persons, one God, existed in eternity past and have loved one another and lavished their love upon one another to honor and delight, almost like a fountain of water flowing across, splashing on each other. And the picture I have is one of just sort of an old Southern dance from about 150 years ago. They called it a Virginia reel, where the three are just sort of twisting and turning and just delighting in each other like a dance. You and I have been invited to participate and to experience that joy and delight as the greatest reality in life. Community number one. Community number two is the church community. We talked about this last week. And whereas the Trinity is the delightful dance of the Trinity, our dance is more the stumbling dance of the saved or the saints. When it comes to trying to reflect that kind of love to other people like us, we are a people who naturally step on each other's toes and trip each other and trip over our own feet. And we have a long way to go. And so our church life, in our particular church, that is something we aspire to accept about ourselves, that we are a people who have a long way to go. That's not a discouraging thing. That's just a reality thing. And we are a people who believe in mercy and the wonder of God's grace for people such as ourselves. Third, we're going to talk about the stumbling dance of the lost. You'll notice that the title is very similar to the stumbling dance of the saved. It's just a little bit different kind of stumbling that we do. Now, a few years ago, my family all flew to Chicago to attend a wedding. It was the wedding of my niece. And my sister has three kids about the same age as my three. Girl, boy, girl. And at the time, they were about something like 31, 29, and 25, something like that. And the music was playing at the reception pretty loud, and everybody was dancing, and I really wanted to go out there and dance with everybody. Now, but I had two things going against me. One is my wife hates dancing. Hates dancing. I've gotten her on the dance floor one time, I believe, at somebody's wedding, for only a partial dance, and then the hatred became so much that she said, "I'm done." And we walked back to our table. But, you know, but now, in this generation, unlike mine, you don't have to have a dance partner to dance anymore. So I'm sitting there thinking, I'm waiting for my opportunity. Now, what I'm waiting for is a song that I recognize. Now, I waited about 45 minutes and then came to the conclusion that it was more than likely I was not going to hear a song that I recognized, that I just needed to pick a song and jump into the fray and do the best I could, which I did. So, I'm out there having fun. You might, if you'd been there, accuse me of being drunk, but I tell you, I had not had a drop of alcohol. Music's going on, lights are kind of low, probably about, I don't know what, 75 people on the dance floor, most of them Christie's age, and I get out there and I just start busting the moves. I'm looking up at the ceiling, I'm looking down at the floor. Let me interject a thought. I was looking up and I was looking down for about 30 seconds, and then I finally looked out around me. And a strange phenomenon had happened, which you've seen at many dances. All the other people stopped dancing, and they made a large circle about like this, and they're all clapping to the music. I looked around, I was the only one dancing. And for about 3 seconds, I thought, I still got it. Still got it. Then I looked for my three adult children. I couldn't find them anywhere. I'm still dancing, doing my moves. And then I see them over in the far corner of the building, hiding, cowering beneath the table, hoping that nobody would associate the idiot on the dance floor with those three back there. Now, I thought I was a pretty good dancer. That's what I thought. Until I saw my three children who had disappeared, and then I looked around me, and about half of the people were laughing while they were clapping, and the other half seemed to me to be politely trying not to laugh. Some were more successful than others. Ah, yes, the stumbling dance of the lost. It's possible to think that you're a pretty good person and have no idea that you're not. It's possible to think you're a pretty good dancer and have no idea that you're not, even when it's obvious to everybody else in the room. The lost community. We've all been there. We know what it's like to be lost. And if you've become saved, somebody has come alongside of you and shared the message with you. And they have also been the messenger. Maybe you've had several people who've been messengers but have shared the message with you. When we do this, this is a little bit more complex than we first imagined. Because the message that we share, just the message we share, is not always warmly received. And Paul tells us this should not be a surprise. For some, he says, the message of Christ is the aroma of life. And for others, it's the aroma of death. Paul says in 2 Corinthians that for some, the message of the cross is power to change our life. But for others, the message of the cross is foolishness. The Greek word is maria. It's foolish. Don't want anything to do with that. And then Jesus himself said, sometimes we're going to be persecuted for righteousness' sake. The message itself sometimes is offensive to the person. But my observation, both in my personal life and among us Christians, is that the problem really is less the message and more how we come across as messengers. You've heard this on countless occasions that Christians are self-righteous and holier than thou and think they're better than everybody else. What they're saying is, whether it's correct or not, is that they are picking up an aroma not from the message but from the messenger. An attitude, something of superiority to them. And what happens is the message gets shut down. Not because here of the message, but because of the messenger. I'm going to look at some passages that are pretty familiar to us. Matthew 10:17, Jesus is about to send his disciples out on a mission trip, and he gives them some instructions. Verse 17, he says, be on your guard against men. They will hand you over to the local councils, flog you in their synagogues. On my account. Now here, he's talking about the message, not the messenger, the message. On my account, you will be brought before governors and kings as witnesses to them and to the Gentiles. Here he's saying, be alert. I'm sending you into dangerous waters because sometimes the message by itself is going to cause you some big trouble. But then verse 16, he tells them a word about what it's like to be a messenger. I am sending you out like sheep among wolves. Like sheep among wolves. Dangerous territory. Therefore, be as shrewd as snakes and innocent as doves. Shrewd as snakes, innocent as doves. Now, what does he mean by shrewd as snakes? He's talking about something like our mental capacity, how we think, what we see as we're out in the lost world on a mission trip, or whether you go to work tomorrow and see people in your office. How are we to think about people? Now, when I think about this, I think about there's a lot of different kinds of lost people, and I, before I became a Christian, was in several of these. At one extreme end, there is the lost person who would say to you, I know you think I'm lost, but I don't give a rip. I'm living my life, and if Jesus is good for you, fine. But don't try to give me any of that Jesus garbage. I don't want anything to do with the church or the Bible or any of that stuff. That's one kind of lost. Back a little bit from that is the person who would say, I don't think I'm lost. I'm having a pretty good time. I know what to do. I'm having fun. Don't tell me I'm lost. I'm not changing a thing. For that person, they have no awareness of being lost at all. Now, one step removed from that is the person who says, something's missing. I don't know what it is. Something's not right. I keep making messes. I keep thinking I'm going to do better at this, but I'm not. But I don't think I'm lost. I think I can fix this. I'm just not sure how. But I know that the answer doesn't have to do with church or Jesus. And then the first kind of lost is somebody that says like this. I know I'm lost. I've lost my direction. I've lost what's important. I've lost a relationship with God. Nothing is like it seems like it ought to be, or nothing important is as it seems it ought to be. I don't know how to fix it. I keep making messes, even when I think I'm not going to make a mess this time. I need somebody outside of me to fix me. When Jesus says to be as shrewd as snakes or as serpents, he's saying, use your head. Think about the different people and where they are in your life and relate to them accordingly. Now, the second thing he says, shrewd as snakes, and second, innocent as doves. Here he's talking about our attitude towards people. Our attitude towards people. Now, innocent as doves, what does he mean here? He probably picks as simple a word, innocent, as disarming a word as he can think of, innocent. And then he picks an illustration that's both, is also as disarming as can be, of a dove. And he says, that's the attitude at which people should sense as you're relating to them. You're using your head. And at the same time, though, no matter where the person is on the scale of lostness, what your attitude needs to be is no harm here. No harm here. Innocent as a dove. Let's illustrate this. Jesus demonstrated this one of the stories I like is when he meets Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus was a hated tax collector. Everybody knew he was a cheat and a swindler, was taking advantage of the people on collecting taxes, and there was nothing the people could do about it. Jesus comes into Jericho, and the people are lined up along the streets, and Jesus sees this guy up in the tree, and he says, Zacchaeus, come down. I'm going to have lunch at your house today. And Zacchaeus must have been stunned, as well as all the other people who knew this scoundrel. They go to have lunch at his house, and during that time he's there, we don't have any of the details, but he repents of his sin. He offers restitution in abundance back to those he's cheated. And then Jesus sums up this little story in two verses. Today, salvation has come to this house because this man, Zacchaeus, too, is a son of Abraham. He's become a believer. For the Son of Man, Jesus himself, came to seek and to save what was lost. Now, think about the different words that Jesus could have used in place of that last word there. He could have said to that crowd, the Son of Man came to seek the cheats, the people who have taken advantage of others, the sinners. Could have used those words. There's a lot of words he could have used. The Son of Man came to seek and to save the liberals, the progressives, those who watch MSNBC. The enemy. Could have used a lot of words there. But he uses a word, it's very intriguing, lost. Lost. Now, unfortunately, I have some experience beyond being spiritually lost, I've been physically lost. Several years ago, I was at a retreat with some pastor friends of mine, pastor planning retreat up at Thousand Pines Camp up in the mountains. And the first afternoon there, I said, I'm going to go on a run. So I got my shoes on, and I took off into the forest. I had a trail map with me, with no experience of how to read a trail map. Somebody had just thrown that at my way. And I ran for about 45 minutes through the woods and suddenly realized I had no idea where I was. I was lost. I tried to read my trail map. I tried to remember where I had been. I remembered seeing old shows where the smart people leave behind bits of cloth on trees to remember where they had been and realize I had failed to do that. By this time in the afternoon, it was getting hot. And of course, I had no water, no food, no sun protection, no hat, nothing if I had to be on the mountain at night to protect me from cold. And of course, I had told no one where I was going, what I was doing, and I didn't even take my smartphone with me. Looking at this map, all I'm seeing is trees. I see some wires off in the distance going down like this, and I'm thinking, the zip line. So I start running through the trees down into this valley, down into the valley, and I see the lines coming down. I'm thinking, wherever that ends, I'll be at camp. And then as I notice through the trees, the lines started going back up again, and I'm thinking, that's an unusual zip line. It was, of course, telephone wires. I had managed to make myself more lost than I was at the beginning. I retreated back up the mountain, and I thought, I may be here a while. I have no water, but I did see a tree with apples on it, little green apples. There were probably 20 apples on this tree, and every apple I saw, a worm had burrowed into the middle of it and was no longer there. I thought, you know, for the first time today, maybe I need to be smart about this. So I took, I don't know, 8 or 10 apples and ate around the holes because that was about the only liquid that I was going to get and maybe the only food I was going to get. I thought, I wonder if a bear has already spotted me. Or a wolf. Maybe a pack of wolves. And they are stalking me. I finally remembered somewhere during the run, I had seen a road. And I thought the road was in that direction. And that being my last hope, I headed away from where I thought I'd started to the road. And I got to a road, and I won't bore you with the details, but I made it home. Now, when I told my friends what I had done, I was met with many eye rolls and laughter because this was not a surprise to my friends. The next day, I decided I was going to be smart about a run, and I was going to run within the confines of the camp to mitigate against getting lost. However, after running in circles for about 30 minutes, I saw something interesting over there, some houses. And so I decided just to run through the neighborhood. Now, that neighborhood was not on campgrounds, and after a while, after so many left turns and right turns, I had gotten lost in a neighborhood. I tried to make my way back, but I did not, of course, think about street names or right-hand or left-hand turns when I was running. I was just running. But I thought, hey, this time I got my smartphone. I pulled out my smartphone. No cell coverage. Now, when I got back and told my friends about this, one of my buddies started laughing, and he said, Seth, he got a pen and he got a marker, and he wrote on a big piece of paper, and he said, before you go out tomorrow, I want to pin this on your shirt. And this is what it said. Assume I'm lost, return me to Thousand Pines Camp. You see pins, you know, on this, and please help this moron. Now, what I want you to think about, let's say on day one, when I was lost in the woods, you were an experienced hiker. You came over the hill, you had food, you had water, you had a hat, you had sunscreen, you had a trail map, you had on actual hiking boots. You were prepared for both the heat and the cold. And let's say that I saw you and went running up to you, what would you think as I told you my story? I'm lost in the woods, I have no water, I have no food. I didn't bring water, I didn't bring food. I didn't bring a hat, I didn't bring any kind of protection from the sun. I didn't bring any protection if I got caught up here on the mountain at night, and I'm hot and thirsty now. What would you think? Exactly. Exactly. What most of us would think is, I am talking to a moron. I am talking to an idiot. What is this fool doing up here? What you'd be tempted to say is, did you tell anybody where you were going? And what would come out of you as you, how you saw the person would affect your attitude towards the person, and without you even knowing it, you'd be creating how you're relating to this person that they would pick up. Probably the first thought through your head would not be, ah, been there, done that. Hey, come with me. I know where we're headed. That is a very different response. Now, what's the difference in that response? If you remember what it's like to be lost and are not surprised when anybody gets lost, that's the most natural attitude you'll have. Been there, done that. I've been lost before too. Worse than this. Come with me. Hey, I got some water. Here's a protein bar. No problem. You follow me on this? How we see the person, how we think of the person, affects our attitude toward the person, and our attitude affects how we relate to the person. That person, we're the messenger, they pick up that attitude, whether we're aware of it or not, and they have some kind of visceral response to that attitude without us even knowing that's what's going on. Now, with that story, I want to look at an example of Jesus doing this again. Now, the tax collectors in Luke 15, the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear him. Now, this is an amazing thing about Jesus. He was the holiest person that ever lived. Perfect. Who likes to be around the perfect person? Nobody likes to be around the perfect person. But these folks did. What we would call the dregs of society. The losers. The people who've lost everything. The people that everybody else looked down on. They like to be around him. And my question is, why? It's not a matter of if they were perfect or how perfect they were. That's not the issue. The issue is, what attitude were they, how was he relating to them based on what attitude he had to them, based on how he saw them? Verse 2, the contrast. But the Pharisees and teachers of the law, the religious leaders, muttered, this man welcomes sinners and eats with them. They had a label for these people. That label affected how they saw the person. How they saw the person affected their attitude towards their person. And their attitude towards that person affected how they related to them. And the effect of that was nobody wanted to be around the Pharisees or teachers of the law. You wouldn't be caught dead there, even at a party. You excuse yourself, I got to go to the bathroom. Whether you have to go to the bathroom or not, I'm out of here. Jesus tells a story. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Does he not leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? Now, what is he saying about this one sheep? What is he assuming about that one sheep? This sheep, you might say, was a moron to leave the 99. They were an idiot like I was up on the mountain. Just off by myself. But that's not how he sees that one. He sees that one sheep as having extreme value. So much value that he's willing to exert himself at even some cost to himself, exposing himself to danger, to go find that sheep. Because that sheep is not a moron. That sheep is valuable. When he finds, does he leave the 99 until and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? Verse 5. When he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders. Now, this is joy here as he associates with the lost person who's been found. And joy here is just the shepherd and the one sheep. He puts the sheep on his shoulders. And he's excited about this prospect. He's found his sheep. And there is joy there. It's not a lecture. It's not a moron. You didn't tell anybody where you were going. You left without food and water. What were you thinking? You weren't thinking. That was the problem. My mother's words. Just. He's joyful. Why? Because the sheep is of value. Now, this is community number 3. The shepherd amidst the sheep, and there's joy. It says, then Jesus says he heads home, verse 6. He calls his friends and neighbors together and says, rejoice with me, I found my lost sheep. This is community number 2. They're brothers and sisters. I found my sheep, and we're all rejoicing together. Everybody's happy about this because the sheep is of incredible value. And then I tell you in the same way, verse 7, there will be more rejoicing in heaven. He uses the adverb, more rejoicing in heaven, over one sinner who repents than the 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent. He suddenly gives us a glimpse into community number 1. If you could just see heaven right now, the Father and Spirit are just jumping for joy. They like this so much. And if I was there, I'd be right there with them. And you know what? All the people who are there, they're doing the same thing. Wow. We found George. Found Jim. We found Beth. Yes. Something joyful is happening there. How we see people affects our attitude towards people. Our attitude affects how we relate to people. Let's look at what Peter says to us. Verse Peter 3. In your heart, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give a reason for the hope that you have. Now, as Christians, it's my observation, could be wrong here, but as Christians, generally, we stop reading that verse right there at the word have. Give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. All right, I got it. What am I supposed to do? That's what we think. But somehow, we've eliminated, for the most part, that last sentence. But do this with gentleness and respect. In other words, the first part of that has to do with what message are we sharing, and we give little credence to the messenger part of this. Now, Peter says there are two important things if you're going to be a messenger here. The first one is, he says, is gentleness. Gentleness. He's talking about how we're relating to somebody. When are you gentle? I'm gentle when I'm putting away glasses in our house. I'm most gentle when I'm putting away my mother's glasses. I'm gentle when I'm putting those away. Because my mother and father got those when they were married back in 1951. We had them in our cupboard. Occasionally we use those, serve ice cream in. I'm gentle when I walk into a room when my children were little, particularly in a crib, and sleeping. I'm gentle when I go to pick up a newborn, whether that be mine or his. Gentle. That's the image he's using here in how we relate to lost people. Kid gloves. Go easy. Relax. Something important is going on here. Don't let your ego get in the way. Gentle. The second word he uses here is the word respect. In the Greek language, it can also be translated reverence. Now, what's he saying here? What's different from gentle? What does respect add to this? Respect here, he's talking another picture about how we relate to somebody. And if you add the word reverence, what does he mean here? I think he means this. Please remember that when you talk to a lost person, you are talking to somebody who's important to God. Because they've been created by God and because they're made in his image. If for no other reason, no matter what else is involved in this person's history, this person is worthy of relating to them respectfully. You catch this? It doesn't matter whether they're on this scale of lostness or on the far extreme scale of lostness. Gentleness and respect. Now, where do we get in trouble on this? I want to wrap up with this. Sometimes as Christians, we go astray when we substitute the good for the best. And it's an easy thing to do. I've done it myself on many occasions. And Paul gives us three examples of this. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels but have not love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. What he's thinking about is that time when you're sharing the Lord with somebody, and there's sort of this sense of, got it going. For once, I'm saying the right things. I'm moving ahead. But you sort of become, maybe not oblivious to the person, but next to oblivious, and their responses, and how are they receiving this, and what's going on here, and you're just kind of on your high horse, just charging through. Now, what Paul says here is if we're not careful, if the person doesn't sense that you love them, it doesn't matter if you think you love them. What matters is, do they think you love them? If that's the case, no matter how eloquent you may be and what your words are, this is what you're communicating. We've lost sight of the person. Verse 2. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have faith that can move mountains. He mentions four great gifts. It'd be nice to have all four of those. But all it takes is one of those to become in my radar screen, and the focus becomes on me and not the lost person. I substitute the good for the best. It doesn't matter how gifted I may be or how gifted you may be, how much knowledge we have, what kind of gift of prophecy we may have, our understanding about Scripture or our faith. If we leave love out of the equation, if it's not the horse pulling the cart, then notice what he says. But have not love, and this is a little bit different. He says, I am nothing. That's different. What does he mean? He doesn't mean I'm a loser or my self-esteem is zero. That's not what he means. When he says I am nothing, he says it's something like this. You might as well not even have showed up. It's almost like you're an invisible person. You're there sort of in this glass case exhibiting your gifts and saying what you want to say and thinking that you're a pretty good Christian and you're on a roll here, but this person is not tuned into what you're saying. You might as well not even have showed up. Without love, I am nothing. And he gives a third example. If I give all I possess to the poor, surrender my body to the flames, but have not love, I gain nothing. Here he's talking about some pretty committed folks. These guys aren't just casual Christians walking in once a month or so. These guys got skin in the game. They're walking with God. They're serious about this. And likely they have, it has cost them a lot to be a Christian. As good as that is, if the person you're not relating to does not sense you love them, Paul says at the end, I gain nothing, meaning the effect that I'm having is zero. No matter how committed I may think I am, no matter how spiritual I may think I am, no matter how much I may believe that God is really using me in this person right now, that's not what's going on. Nothing is going on. There is no movement in the person's heart. unless love is out front. The horse is love. The cart is the message. In the next few weeks, God may give you some opportunities to talk to some lost people. If somebody rejects the message, that's one thing. But if they reject the message because of the messenger, that's another thing. Now, this is still something I have to be alert in my own life on. A couple years ago, I was trying to share the Lord with a neighbor of mine. And we got into it, and he, on the lost scale, he's pretty far down the road here. I know you're into that Jesus thing, and that's good for you. That's not for me. I don't go to church. Too many hypocrites. And, you know, he kind of had to spiel that. It was not the first rodeo for him in, you know, shutting down a Christian and trying to share more. And I just kind of nodded, and I thought, I got it. And I thought, you know, he's willing to talk about, hey, the Dodgers. Willing to talk about baseball, which is probably what we talked about. He is a good neighbor. He's been a good neighbor to us. But I was sad about that and just sort of, you know, well, I'll just have to table this for some time in the future. A couple years pass, and I find out that his family is splitting apart. His marriage has been slowly drying up and slowly splitting for about 20 years. They've been waiting for the two kids to graduate and get out of the house, which has happened, and he's on his way to another residence. Now, the aroma that I could smell wafting up from my heart was something like this. He didn't really want anything to do with God, huh? And you see no connection between that and what's going on for the last 20 years? How's that working for you? That's the Pharisee. That's how the Pharisee sees the person. That's the attitude that's going to come across unless it's checked. That's how I'm going to relate without me even knowing it's going on, and I'm going to get the same visceral response if we were talking again that I got probably the first time. In those moments, if you find that the person you're talking to is defensive or argumentative, it may be for the message. If that's the case, that's fine. But if you read defensiveness and argumentativeness in the person you're talking to, put a stop sign in front of you. Hold up an invisible mirror and ask yourself, how do I really see this person? What's my real attitude towards this person? How am I relating? Do they sense I love them as priority? Is the horse out in front of the cart? Let's pray together. Father, living in community 2 and 3 both has its challenges, and we've often messed this up a lot. Somehow you kept sending messengers to us when we were lost, and at just the right time we were found. Usually because somebody cared enough about us and loved us, the horse was out in front of the cart, such that when that messenger shared the message, we were more receptive. And in your time, came to faith. Would you help us to be shrewd as serpents, to put our mental caps on, and innocent, harmless as doves with the lost people in our lives?